to another episode of Information Week Live. This is Information Week Live for the week of April 12th, 2015, and I'm your host, Executive Editor Kurt Franklin, Information Week. We've got a great show planned for you today. Going to be trying a couple of interesting new things in terms of our format. And, well, I just think it's going to be a fine session. So we'll get started here in just a minute. Before we do, though, I want to remind everyone that this episode of Information Week Live is part of our Information Week community. Another piece of that, of course, is the live component. Interop Las Vegas, connecting the IT community, comes your way April 27th through May 1st, 2015, from the beautiful Mandalay Bay Convention Center in Las Vegas, Nevada. For more information and to register, please go to www.interop.com. Be sure, when you do so, to use the promo code RADIO. That promo code RADIO will save you $200 off the full conference price. And today, we're going to be talking about something else that's going to be happening at the same time, in the same place, that just notches up the excitement a little bit more. But before we get there, I want to introduce my guest today. We have the always popular Dave Wagner here. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
And if I'm not mistaken, Chris Murphy, the editor of Information Week, has joined us as well. Is that you, Chris?
That's correct.
Oh, well, welcome to Information Week Live. Glad to have both you gentlemen on board with us. Now, Chris, one of the things that I promised our listeners just a minute ago was that we were going to talk about something that's happening at the same time as Interop. We're having our very own conference for Information Week, aren't we? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The Information Week conference is April 27 and 28. So that's the Monday and Tuesday of the Interop Week at the same location. It's in its own kind of environment within the Mandalay Bay Center. And so that's focused on IT leader and IT leadership issues. And so killer lineup of speakers, really top-notch thinkers from the CIO of Walmart, Karen Anterell, CIOs of ConocoPhillips, the NBA, the Royal Caribbean. We're going to have a great panel on, are you a software development company? And the answer should be yes, where we talk to Allstate and Pinterest, two very different companies, long-established companies, and a born-on-the-web company, about how they're both really trying to change how they think about software development and making it core to who they are and what they are.
Well, now, this sounds like the thing that a lot of people will want to come to. Is it too late to register for the Information Week conference? Is that something that people will have to put on their agenda for next year, or do we still have some room there?
No, they can still get in there. InformationWeek.com/conference. They can come and sign up. Love to have them.
That we would, and of course, we wouldn't be Information Week if we didn't say that we are going to cover the Information Week conference. We hope that you can be there. It's going to be a great thing. But to add to your conference-going experience, we'll be covering it. And if you are, well, just so darned unlucky that you can't make it this year, we'll be able to bring you a small taste of what's going on out in Las Vegas. Be sure to follow everything that's happening at informationweek.com for your complete Information Week conference and Interop coverage. Well, we want to talk about a number of things today, and I'm going to toot my own horn here. I had a chance a week or so ago to spend some time on the phone with Chris Anderson. Now, he's the former chief editor of Wired magazine. He's the founder and now CEO of a company called 3D Robotics, which, despite its name, doesn't really sell industrial robots. What it sells is drones. Chris has written a book on makers. As a matter of fact, that's the title of the book. And we had a great conversation. I read the book in preparation for the conversation, found it fascinating. Chris, you were my editor on that article. I've got to ask, what did you think about the things that Chris Anderson had to say about the maker movement?
Well, I think I think the point, and you drew out this point about that the maker movement, which could be thought of just as a hobbyist kind of thing of this is tinkerers in their backyard, that it has a real application to business technology. And, you know, I was curious your take on that, of what your thought is of how much you think this maker movement, this tinker in the basement kind of mentality applies to business technology and the business technology decision people.
Well, you know, I tend to be a big fan of the maker movement. I say that because I sort of come out of that world. I spent my childhood, my youth, and much of my adult life building things. It's just, to me, the way you make things happen. I liked one of the things that Chris had to say when he compared where we are right now with 3D printing with where we were back in the mid to late 80s with desktop publishing. I can remember the first Apple laser writer to come into my office. At that time, I was working at Byte magazine, and we got one in the editorial office at Byte. We're able to make things happen, but a lot of people were worried that we were going to unleash this, you know, horrific flood of bad typography on the landscape, that all of a sudden we were just going to have unreadable stuff foisted upon us. And there was a little bit of that, but, you know, what you found pretty quickly was that people were able to chew up that learning curve. And today, you know, we can't imagine being in a business environment where people don't have, you know, the basics of, you know, desktop publishing available to them no matter where they are. And I really think that the whole 3D printing and, as he put it, desktop prototyping world is going to get there. Dave,
well, how much do you think, Kurt, that notion of, I think it's really interesting what he brought out about 3D printing, this notion of that we're moving back to a world of atoms and experimenting with atoms like we have as opposed to a focus entirely on digital. But how much does his argument pivot on this idea of 3D printing, that 3D printing will get good enough and take off and be the dream that we see today?
Well, they really are bound up pretty well together. Now, he takes some pains to point out that in the broader category of desktop prototyping hardware, which is really what we're talking about, you have things like 3D printers. Those are all the extruders and the lithography devices that we're used to seeing, that those are coming along. But we also have the machines that take away. There are all kinds of little desktop prototyping cutters, many of them based on putting a Dremel type tool into some sort of XYZ 3D axis machine to cut away material. And then there's the flatter cutting, all the various vinyl cutting and paper cutting devices that are out there, die cuts. We get, you know, sort of stuck on the 3D printing, but that's not nearly all of what's going on. And I think that that's important because you have this whole world of people who are very proficient in some of the cutting technologies. I know my own dear wife has several of the vinyl and paper cutting devices that he was talking about. So I think the entire category of tools is getting better. And the cool thing about it is that as these tools get better, they're also getting easier to use. And that combination means that the floor in terms of quality is going up. You know, we're getting to the point where it's possible to spit out a small prototype to show someone what you're thinking of with a product, or to bring into the world of atoms a small replacement part that might be required for something that's long out of production. So I do think we're going to get there, but I suspect that for it to be, you know, get into anything like full flower and real broad acceptance, it's going to take us the better part of another decade.
You know, Kurt, another great thing about this movement, all these tools you mentioned, one of the things it really does is it puts the power back into the garage. You know, most of our largest industries of the 20th century were founded in a garage, whether it's, you know, Orville and Wilbur Wright working on an airplane in a bicycle shop, or whether it's the invention of the Apple computer in the garage, right? And there's so many other ones in between the car and everything else. One of the things that we lost at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century was the ability for a single person or a small group of people to prototype and create something on a garage budget. Everything required a university to research. By bringing the cost down in the ability to prototype a real object, I think we're really going to see a real revolution in industries that we don't even know exist today, but are going to be invented in the garages of the next decade.
You know, that's really interesting, Dave, and I think that you're very right. Yeah, you know, we tend to go back and forth. It's interesting to watch some of the discussions that we see about the relative importance of the garage, the small, you know, entrepreneur or business person, versus the importance of large companies. And I think that, you know, we're sort of getting back to the importance of those smaller companies, the startups. There are pockets where that happens. I think the U.S. is one of them. And the recent financial turmoil may well have helped that, because historically, when jobs have not been available with larger companies, we have tended to basically build our own jobs. And the whole desktop prototyping tool set and movement makes that much more possible. But you're also seeing it in much of the developing world, where you have that same sort of spirit that, you know, if jobs are not there to be given to you, well, then you make your own. And so to me, it's fascinating really almost to look at those places where that's not the case and wonder what kind of disadvantage they're going to be at in years to come.
Well, I think it quickens the ability for someone in a developing world to solve their own problems. One of the things that we know is true is that large companies in developed countries aren't interested in solving a lot of the problems of the developing world, either because they don't know what they are or they don't see any money in it. So if it becomes cheaper and easier for somebody in a developing country to solve their own problem, you know, billion-dollar industries can spring up.
You know, one of the things that interests me as well is, and it gets back to this notion of underserved populations. One of our other favorite guests here on Information Week Live has come on the line. Sarah Peters, senior editor at Dark Reading, is now on the line. And Sarah, I know that you're here primarily to scare the willies out of us, but before we get to that, I'm curious, because one of the things that this whole maker movement seems to be doing is becoming a pathway for more women to get into the tech world. And I'm curious about your take on that. Is that something that you have run across any evidence of? And do you think that that's a good purpose for all of this maker technology?
That's a really interesting question. I think yes. I mean, me personally, I'm one of those people that I'm so useless at making anything. My husband laughs because if I pick up a knife, he gets immediately wants to run for the medical kit because my knife skills are just that bad. I'm just not handy in any way, shape, or form. But I do think that would be a way to maybe ease that pathway. But I think, I just kind of feel like any way that we can make the progression or the jump from make it just that transition a little bit easier to get more women into technology, or just more people who do not generally think of themselves as technologists into technology, is a good thing, because I think a lot of people are tinkerers, but they don't necessarily think of themselves as smart people. You know what I mean? I think that a lot of people don't give themselves credit for the kind of intellect that they have, and IT would be very well served by people who have that practical kind of intelligence that aren't necessarily the people who are just good at math and good in school. The people who kind of gravitate more towards the vocational people that kind of gravitate towards more hands-on types of fields don't necessarily think of themselves as going into IT, and I think that we need to help make that connection happen a little bit more naturally, I think.
Sarah, don't you think the IT industry is very much a show-me industry? It's very easy, I think, if you can show, whether it's an app or something you've designed, if you can show that you've done it and you can do it, it's so much easier to be respected. And I think that's true in security. If you can show somebody you've done the right kind of hack or the right kind of exploit discovery, and it's true in engineers, I built this, I developed that. And the maker movement, too, just seems to be a show-me kind of place. I think that's really the connection, is that we really want to see somebody's chops before we give them respect.
I agree, but I think it's become that. I think it's getting that way more and more as the industry becomes flashier. I think maybe that's becoming increasingly more important too.
You know, it's interesting that Dave, you brought up that show me. Earlier today, I was with the group of people who are code school based out of Orlando, and I also talked to one of the founders of an organization called Ladies Learning Code out of Toronto. And both of them were talking about the importance of being able to show what you do. Greg, who was the founder of Code Schools, talked about employers who now, rather than wanting to know what university you might have graduated from, want to know what your handle is on GitHub. They want to see your GitHub portfolio, see the code that you've written. And that is becoming a form of credential that is more important in many places than a diploma. And I find that fascinating, as you say, that we're getting to that show me. Don't tell me which classes you attended. Show me what you did as a result of those classes. And there's nothing that's easier to show than some 3D object that is sitting in your hand. Chris, I want to turn to you because you live sort of in part of our nation's industrial heartland. Is the maker movement something that you hear much about up where you are?
I would say it's probably not that much different here. So I'm in Milwaukee, that much different than elsewhere around the country where it's a niche. I think it's not you know, things like 3D printing there's a small core who see the potential. You've got people playing with it, but I don't think it's, you know, sweeping the nation yet.
Well, that's true of any kind of engineering, right? I mean, as much as I wish the whole country was overwhelmed with designing superconductors in their spare time, the truth is that we've always had just a small portion of our country who does most of the inventing and the tinkering and the building and the fixing.
But I do think the barriers, that this is about the barriers falling, and whereas all of us can put together a collage now of a half dozen photos in some way very quickly and easily, and that used to take a professional's hand, that this does offer the potential for at least showing, hey, this is my idea. I don't know how I would ever make this thing, but this is what it would look like.
Well, it's fascinating that we're talking about this, and there's a lot more. You know, I've written a couple of articles on the Internet of Things, and that's one of the topics that our audience, our community here at Information Week, is very interested in. So I think that we're going to have some more discussion about all of this. I want to avoid hogging the entire conversation today because we've got some other great things to talk about. One of them comes out of the security world. Sarah, I know that you came by not just to enjoy a discussion about 3D printing, although I know that that's one of the great loves of your life, the whole 3D printing area. but you know, what's been going on in what the evil hackers are doing to us in security this week?
Well, let's see. We have some that kind of backhanded good news that I can share. This week there was a report that came out by FireEye about a group called APT-30, which is a cyber espionage group that they believe is a nation state funded actor in China that mostly goes after targets in Southeast Asia. And it's really fascinating. It's a fascinating report because this attack group has been around for over 10 years, and it's really a well-oiled machine kind of. It reminds me almost of a telemarketing company in that they have shifts, and the operator kind of logs in, and there's little notations about which target is the priority that day, and they can formally prioritize certain ones over others. They have a very, very detailed process for malware development. That's much better organized than any of the enterprise software that you're running. This group was able to get after air-gapped machines before other China-based groups were. It's really, really a very impressive group. And at the same time that this report was coming out about APT-30, CrowdStrike was also telling us about some success they were having with a different China-based attack group called Hurricane Panda. And this, I think, you're going to find really kind of fascinating, Kurt. CrowdStrike had been working with a company that had been really taken over by Hurricane Panda. They were had completely infiltrated this company's systems, And after a couple months, CrowdStrike had finally kicked Hurricane Panda out entirely, completely done the remediation. And very diligently, Hurricane Panda guys kept trying to get in daily. There were daily attempts to try to get back in through the usual measures, which is their method of choice is a web shell called China Chopper. And after about 3 or 4 months of these daily attempts that were unsuccessful, they decided, okay, we're going to try something different. And they invested in a Windows kernel zero-day vulnerability, which could cost up to tens of thousands of dollars to buy on the black market. So this is a really sophisticated and expensive tool that the attackers decided to drop the cash on. And CrowdStrike was able to see that. They stopped the attack. They spotted the vulnerability. They reported it to Microsoft, which patched it, which means that now that vulnerability isn't going to be of any use to the attackers because that client has, you know, installed that patch, and anybody else that was that had that vulnerability, they're going to have patched it too. So Hurricane Panda decided eventually, all right, forget it. We're going to stop trying to compromise that organization. After 4 months of daily attempts to get back in, they gave up. And then a few months later, the same kind of situation was happening at a different company. And this was the part that I found really fascinating. CrowdStrike saw Hurricane Panda actually run a command to check to see if the company had the CrowdStrike software installed. And when attackers saw that it was, they just backed out and left and stopped trying to attack it. So what they decided was that whether or not this is a pattern that can, you know, this is only two occasions, so you can't really say that this is a big trend. But what it does seem to show is that if you can frustrate the attackers enough, if you can make it expensive enough for them, they might just give up and go elsewhere. Even a really, really motivated nation-state actor might decide that it just isn't worth the trouble. So that was a little bit of a victory we heard about this week.
I love the idea that we're having some victories. And I also love the idea that we've gotten to the point where the attackers are going to go after the low-hanging fruit rather than the entire internet being low-hanging fruit. we now at least have some organizations that are starting to up their game to the point that it the cost-benefit ratio of attacking them is changing. And I think that's very good news. I do find it fascinating. You know, we've been talking about the whole making and credentials and versus what you can do argument. And it does seem to me that security is one of these areas that has traditionally been a show me what you can do field. And yet we're in a time right now when universities are falling all over themselves to add cybersecurity and cyber forensics degrees to try and attract young people and offer them credentials, basically telling them, come here and get your credential, and it will be better than anything you can do simply by showing how skilled you are. It is a fascinating area. Sarah, I'm glad you brought that to us, and I'm glad you're here for the wider conversation. And on that conversation, we're going to pivot now for the final segment of the program to our traditional final segment, and that is the Geek End, where this week Dave managed to combine two of my very favorite topics, space travel and coffee. Dave, so I've got to ask, from your point of view, which was more important about the mission that Well, I think the supply ship was supposed to dock just a short while ago. But
yeah, I believe it's actually undocked now, yes. But at least if it held to the previous plan, it may have needed to change a few things by a few hours, but yes.
Well, you know, we had two, you know, I think almost groundbreaking things. One, SpaceX tried for the second time to land the first stage, the spent first stage, on a barge. And
yeah.
And they came reasonably close to
succeeding. Oh, agonizingly close, Kurt.
and that's one thing that's important that we can talk about. But the other is that finally, after decades of space travel, the scientists working in the space station finally have espresso. And,
yeah.
And I predict that we're going to see a whole new level of scientific discovery coming.
I believe I believe everyone will work much better in space now.
See, you guys know that I hate space, and the very idea of going into space is something that I've always eschewed. But the idea of there being espresso up there does make me a little bit more amenable to the idea.
Well, you know, this sounds like a silly thing, right? And it is on a certain level to be talking about coffee in space. But there's actually some very serious science behind this. As anybody who has ever thought about how coffee is made by warm or hot liquid going across ground coffee, right? Well, liquid doesn't behave the way it's supposed to in microgravity. And in fact, if you had a cup full of coffee in space and you tried to drink it and you turned it as you normally would on the ground, the liquid wouldn't even leave the cup. What you would actually have to do is throw it at your face to drink it. And so this is a serious scientific problem, because many, many experiments that we want to conduct in space require the use in one way or another of liquid, and we don't know how it moves. Until recently, we did not know how it moves. And the creation of both the espresso machine and the zero-gravity coffee cup, which allows you to drink coffee the way you would on Earth by simply tipping the cup over and sipping out of it like you would on Earth, represent decades of experience and understanding and the way liquid moves in microgravity. So it's fun to talk about it from the point of view of caffeine and just that it's fun to talk about coffee, but it actually is quite the achievement.
Well, now, to be honest, I have to say that throwing coffee at my face is probably an accurate description of what I've done after many late nights of writing. that's not so far-fetched, but you're right. It is wonderful to see the engineering used here. And I say this, you know, the engineering of what has to happen in microgravity is fascinating. And I had the chance many years ago to work with one of the engineers who designed the toilet on Spacelab, which he could describe the considerations in agonizing detail, especially at dinner. But, you know, as you say, doing everyday things in an unusual environment carries just a whole host of engineering considerations with it, along with anything else. Chris, if you're still on the line, I'm curious. I don't recall. Are you a coffee person? And if so, does the addition of an Italian espresso machine make you more likely to apply to head up to the ISS?
Well, it's quite certain that we aren't getting to Mars without coffee. So it's got to be done. You know, we're not getting. Nobody's going to sign up for that journey.
And interestingly enough, we're not going to get to Mars without the other half of the SpaceX mission either, which is landing that first stage on a barge.
Well, you know, I wanted to talk about that because now we've seen two attempts, and this was, as you say, much, much closer than the first one. And I find it fascinating that people are watching this kind of closely. When we were first starting to put rockets into space at all, there were any number of attempts that didn't make it before we finally succeeded in getting something into orbit. So in a lot of ways, it seems like what's going on with SpaceX is following in the finest tradition of the space program.
Well, it is, and it isn't. On some levels, it's hard. A lot of people are calling this a failure. And in reality, we need to think of this as a success. And the reason is that there are two parts to this mission, right? And the first part of the mission is to take supplies to the International Space Station cheaply. That they're already achieving. They have a 100% success rate in getting supplies to the International Space Station. They are doing it at roughly, depending on whose estimates you want to believe, at roughly half the cost of what the space shuttle could do it at. If they succeed at landing this Stage 1 rocket back safely to Earth with no damage, they're going to slash the cost of space travel even more, because the biggest expense and the biggest turnaround time problem right now is that right now we're building every rocket from scratch. And if we could take those Stage 1 rockets and bring them back to Earth safely, not having to find them in the ocean somewhere, not having to rebuild them, it would save millions of dollars per launch. What is fascinating is in 1972, the cost of moving a pound of material to space was something on the order of $38,000 per pound. The space shuttle, depending on which estimate you want to believe, did it from between $13,000 and $27,000 per pound. But Richard Nixon mandated when the space shuttle was built that they would reduce that price to $1,000 per pound. And the space shuttle was supposed to be able to achieve launching every 2 weeks and bringing cargo into space at $1,000 a pound. It clearly did not come even close to those kinds of numbers. Sort of a massive failure from what its original mission was, though there are many successes you can point to in the space shuttle program. So what SpaceX may do, though there are still plenty of work to do, is they may finally achieve the cost of putting things in space that Richard Nixon had hoped the space shuttle would do by 1978.
You know, that's very interesting, because I can remember when the space shuttle was spoken of in terms like a pickup truck for space. And, you know, as you point out, it never came close to achieving that goal for a whole variety of reasons. But I know I heard Elon Musk, the CEO of SpaceX and Tesla, give a speech a couple of years ago. And he was asked why those two companies. And he talked about what each could teach the other. And he pointed out that the automotive industry is really great with figuring out how to make the same thing over and over again, reliably and relatively inexpensively. And what they are terrible with is working with new and cutting-edge materials. Whereas with the space program, it was exactly the opposite. They're great with new, innovative, and cutting-edge materials and have never figured out how to do an assembly line. So in his thinking, the two could teach one another. If he could bring the idea of the assembly line from Tesla to SpaceX and the proficiency in working with new materials and new technologies from SpaceX to Tesla, it would strengthen both companies, and he would be able to do things that other companies can't. And when he said that, it struck me as being exactly right. And it's interesting to see that, you know, they're still working to fulfill the promise of that combination.
Right. They're not there. It should be importantly noted that as hard as I was on NASA in my article and as easy I was on SpaceX, that SpaceX is not there. There are a lot of flaws, just none of which they wouldn't admit themselves. There are a lot of flaws to their program that they're still working out. There are also a lot of flaws to a Tesla that people are still working out. But it is amazing how both are in fact informing on the other. There are more new ideas inside the average Tesla car than your average Ford. I'm sure Ford would contest that, but I think a normal person looking at the two would see the Tesla as a more advanced vehicle. And the Tesla capsules are cheaper and easier to build than any rocket that we've put in space so far.
Well, lots to do. Dave, thanks very much for covering this. You always do it on the Geek End in a way that has some lightness to it, and yet you consistently deal with some very thought-provoking and solid topics. And we appreciate that, and we appreciate you bringing those stories to us here on Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt.
Well, I want to thank all of our guests, Sarah Peters, Senior Editor at Dark Reading, Chris Murphy, the Editor of InformationWeek.com, and Dave Wagner, Executive Editor for Community at InformationWeek.com, for being our guest today. Folks, thank you each for being on our panel today.
Great to be here. Thanks, Kurt.
And thanks to each of you for listening. We appreciate you being here. One of the things that I tend to say over and over again is that we could not and would not do this without you. Now, if you are listening to this in an on-demand version, thank you. We're glad to have you, but you know you're missing something really important, because while we've been talking, there's a great conversation going on in the live chat at informationweek.com. We would love to have you as part of that online chat. Remember, that happens when we go live each Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern. Also want to remind you that this is only part of the radio that we're doing here at Information Week. Every Wednesday at 3 p.m., we have IT Life Radio, hosted by Dave Wagner, who is happy to bring you a great take on the issues around this high-tech life we all live. We've got another one, great one, coming up this coming Wednesday. You can check it out here at InformationWeek.com, and we hope you'll be part of the audience for that. We've also got Interop Radio, which happens every Tuesday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. You know, Interop Radio is a huge part of what we do, and we're getting ready to go into overdrive. Interop, the event, is coming up in 2 short weeks, and there will be a dozen Interop radio programs coming to you live from Las Vegas. Check us out. There will be a post going up in the Interop tab of Information Week that talks about each and every one of those. You can follow me on Twitter. That's KG4GWA to get all the URLs. I hope that you will plan to be with us for each and every one of those great shows live from Interop. Well, for all of us here at Information Week Live, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. You know, we'll see you here next week.